Translation by Srila Prabhupada, followed by purport. The Bhattacharya told the king, "What you have said is right according to the regulative principles governing the visiting of holy places. But there is another path, which is the path of spontaneous love. According to those principles, there are subtle intricacies involved in the execution of religious principles." Purport. According to the Vedic regulative principles, one has to be celibate before entering a holy place of pilgrimage. Generally, people are very much addicted to sense gratification, and unless they have sex at night, they cannot sleep. The regulative principles therefore enjoin that before a common man goes to a holy place of pilgrimage, he should observe complete celibacy. As soon as one enters a holy place, he must observe fasting for the day, and after shaving his head clean, he must take a bath in a river or ocean near the holy place. These methods are adopted to neutralize the effects of sinful activities. Visiting a holy place of pilgrimage means neutralizing the reactions of a sinful life. Those who go to holy places of pilgrimage actually unload the reactions of their sinful lives, and consequently, holy places are overloaded with sinful activities left there by visitors. When a saintly person or pure devotee visits such a holy place, he absorbs the sinful effects left by the common men and again purifies the holy place. Tirthi kurvanti tirthani, Bhagavatam 1:13-10. Therefore, a common man's visit to a holy place and an exalted saintly person's visit there are different. The common man leaves his sins in the holy place, and a saintly person or devotee cleanses these sins simply by his presence. The devotees of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu were not common men, and they could not be subjected to the rules and regulations governing the visiting of holy places. Rather, they exhibited their spontaneous love for Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Immediately upon arrival at the holy place, they went to see Lord Chaitanya, and by his order, they took Mahaprasadam without following the regulations governing holy places. Om Gyan Timirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshuran Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Gadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yata Padakamalam Shri Guru Vaishnavam Cha Shri Rupam Sagra Jatam Sahagana Raghunatam Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padhan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitam Cha He Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vishabhanu Sute Devi Paramame Hari Priye Vancha Kalpatru Bhischa Kripa Sindhu Abhevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadha Shiva Sadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare. So I'm going to just read the translations beginning from verse 104 and then stop at 112. So just following on from yesterday, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya is speaking to Maharaj Prataparudra, and we're at the junction of where he is, of the conversation where he is speaking about the mercy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is necessary for us to be able to understand who he actually is. And he goes on to say that Lord Brahma said, "My Lord, if one is favored by even a slight trace of your mercy, of the mercy of your lotus feet, he can understand the greatness of your personality. But those who speculate to understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead are unable to know you, even they continue to study the Vedas for many years." And the purport explains that this verse is actually a quotation from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, chapter 14, verse 29. And Srila Prabhupada elaborates on it in the Madhya Lila, 6th chapter, text 84. But if we read the purport to that verse, essentially what's happening in that, when Brahma quotes this, is, you know, he's, and Brahma says this to Krishna, is he's really describing that despite all of his amazing material opulence, his knowledge, he was a receiver of the Vedas. He didn't, you know, he got it directly from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So you, one would assume that, wow, if I'm a direct student of someone, then surely I have such a great understanding. You would assume that, right? And this is also Brahma's mood that, oh, I have so much. Of course I will recognize who the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This little blue boy, he's just a magician. So he's been humbled and he is now, you know, actually saying, actually really it's your mercy if you reveal yourself to us. There's nothing really we can do to recognize. There's no qualification we really have, no matter how great we are. No IQ. Your IQ might get you into Mensa, but it won't necessarily, you know, reveal the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Not the wealth that you have. You know, sometimes, you know, devotees do comment whether they see this in India or other temples, even, you know, in other countries. They sometimes comment that, oh, how come the devotees who have more money seem to get more access to the mercy, you know, this is not right. But no, this is actually an incorrect observation. This is just a surface observation, because actually to know the Supreme Personality of Godhead, to be able to be in a relationship of intimate exchange with him is actually really by his mercy. It cannot be bought by anything, not IQ, not wealth, not beauty, not fame, and not even if somebody just thinks we're a great devotee. By their speculation, even that doesn't do anything. So Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, the king said, actually in response, because they're observing, they're standing on this balcony observing what's going on with Lord Chaitanya and his associates. How wonderful, right? Actually, it wasn't wonderful enough from Harish Prataparudra. He wanted close darshan, but he's actually hearing first from Guru. He's hearing first from the Lord's close associate. So he actually observes something. So he's making observations. Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya is commenting. And the king said, instead of visiting the temple of Lord Jagannath, all the devotees are running toward the resident of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya replied, this is spontaneous love. All the devotees are really anxious, very anxious to meet Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. First, the devotees will meet Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and then take him with them to the temple to see Lord Jagannath. Then the king said, the son of Bhavananda Rai, named Vaninath, along with 5 or 7 other men, went there to obtain the remnants of Lord Jagannath's food. Indeed, Vaninath has already gone to the residence of Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and has taken a large quantity of Mahaprasadam. Please let me know the reason for this. Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya said, understanding that all the devotees have come, Lord Chaitanya gave the sign, and therefore Vaninath and the others have brought such great quantities of Mahaprasadam. The king then asked the Bhattacharya, why have the devotees not observed the regulations for visiting the pilgrimage place, such as fasting, shaving, and so on? Why have they first eaten prasadam? The Bhattacharya told the king, what you have said is right according to the regulative principles governing the visiting of holy places. But there is another path, which is the path of spontaneous love. According to those principles, there are subtle intricacies involved in the execution of religious principles. So, you know, sometimes when we're given sets of verses, because there might not be a purport or a long purport, it's usually because there's narration. And the narration is generally descriptive and there's not so much to comment, but there's so much in this narration, because actually it's not just a description, it's Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya's commentary on what Maharaj Pratapurudra is observing. And it's interesting because as the pure devotees do, they're so closely connected with the Lord, even when they're in dialogue with others, they almost have out of compassion, they anticipate where the conversation might go. And it's interesting that before Maharaj Pratapurudra even asks and starts to notice and express discrepancies or things that might be unusual in the activities of Lord Chaitanya and his associates, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya is already anticipating and preempting and prepping his consciousness, but actually already starting to express to him, before he's asked the question, that to understand Krishna, to understand the Supreme Personality of God, it requires his mercy. And so he's quoting from Bhagavatam, okay? And he's adding to that, that actually this is no less for any avatar of the Lord, including Lord Chaitanya, where he's actually come in disguise, okay? And it's interesting because Krishna didn't really hide too much who he was, and he wasn't recognized, right? His activities were great. His activities were super excellent. They weren't able to be repeated by other human beings. He did have special markings on his hands and feet, which were visible to all. And yet, even Duryodhan failed to recognize him. You know, Indra failed to recognize him. Brahma failed to recognize him. Now, you might say, well, Duryodhan was antagonistic. That's why he didn't. But actually, Krishna showed his opulence to Duryodhan. Right? He showed a partial universal form. Pah! Magic tricks, you know? Indra and Brahma were part of Krishna's Leela. They were observing Krishna's Leela directly. And still, they couldn't see. Do you see how, even with the Lord being literally right in front of our eyes, we may not be seeing who he actually is, whether he's there in his personal form, whether he's there as Lord Chaitanya standing just, you know, a few hundred meters away from our balcony, or he's come in his deity form, which is non-different to the Lord. So this, he's already priming us. You know, actually, really, when he lets us in, and by his mercy and the mercy of his devotees, really, that's when we start to see who he actually is. And this mercy factors, we all have this, because we are little offshoots of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You know, we're mini-me's of Krishna, okay? Partial manifestations in many ways. We also have this. People can really only know us if we let them in, isn't it? So why should it be any different? Someone can know our waist measurement, our height, you know, how many degrees we have. They can know a description, a narration of our entire childhood activities. They can even maybe predict our future. Maybe they're an astrologer. They know what our future activities are going to be. But unless we let them in, they're not going to necessarily understand us, what motivates us, what will let them come close to us. Does that make sense? So why would Krishna be any different? The Vedas are like understanding his supplementary aspects, his aspects that allow us to approach him. This is my boundary. This is how much you can know about me for now, until I know you're really serious, until I know you're really invested. So Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, he's already kind of anticipating that. Before you start asking questions, just remember, don't rely on these observations to be conclusive. Don't rely on what you observe, your own mind, your own senses, your own intelligence, to be able to tell you what's actually going on. Because we're so reliant, right? Seeing is believing. But and yet we pay money so that seeing isn't believing. We go to magic shows, right? Right? Illusionists, magicians, they're so famous, they're so appreciated, we're so wowed by them. So we're like, yeah, seeing is believing, but I'll pay you money to put me in illusion. You know, so this is a really, really important point that Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya is already making in preparation for the rest of the conversation. So this mercy, what is the purpose of this mercy? Because one of the aspects of this mercy, when Krishna gives his mercy, is it lifts this veil of illusion, right? It's the illusion that stops us from seeing him when he's right before our eyes. And this illusion is really made up of misconceptions about who we are. Okay, because we spend a lot of time fighting our real identity, pretending it's not there, living in a shadow identity. And it's funny, it's we've dropped our real identity to chase after our shadow identity. How long do you chase after your shadow? Most children give it up after, you know, at an early age. And here we are, grown adults, lifetime after lifetime, we chase after our shadow identity. Why? Because we're so, again, as an offshoot of Krishna, we are actually, our natural state is to be very strong in our identity as a servant of Krishna. In whatever rasa that is, in whatever dynamic that is, we're actually, our natural state is to be very secure in that. It's not unstable. It's not unsteady. By nature, it's not a place of insecurity or not knowing, does he love me? Does he not love me? He loves me. That's it. That's our natural state, right? I am who I am to him, and I'm most important to him. And then we take a shadow identity, which is always fluctuating, changing, right? Because it's always latched into and dependent on our surroundings and our relationships, and they're always changing. So because they're always changing, there's this vulnerability. And so we keep chasing after the shadow. Let me keep it secure. Let me keep it secure. And so when we're distracted like this, we're so distracted like this, it's very difficult because it creates a web of lies that we tell ourselves. This is what the illusion is. It's not some mystical fog that clears, you know, when Krishna reveals, you know, gives us his mercy, that mystical fog clears. Right before our eyes, the entire spiritual world reveals itself with these eyes. No, there's actually awakening in the heart that this, when he reveals himself, we start to understand. We start to understand what he's trying to tell us. We start to really hear from him. We realize actually all this web of, you know, lies that I tell myself about who I am, I don't need to lie to myself anymore. To just feel a sense of purpose, to feel a sense of appreciation, a sense of validation. I exist because Krishna loves me. That's the cornerstone of my existence. So this mercy that Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya is bestowing on Maharaj Pratapurudra cannot be underestimated. You know, we hear over and over again in class, illusion, you know, we're in Maya, we're caught up in our, you know, transient sense of self or false sense of self. Why is this point almost labored? Because we've forgotten so much that we forget the moment we're told. Does that make sense? It's like, it's almost like it's in one ear and out the other, and we just go back into our regular day-to-day activities, again, which are made up of that network of, you know, lies. It's interesting, I was told something by my Guru Maharaj. I was speaking to him about, you know, Bhaktisiddhartha Maharaj, he was very open to discussions about some of the challenges people might have in their personal lives, which might be affecting themselves and the community. And especially back, you know, 20 years ago, our community didn't talk so much about challenges. There was a lot of fear around, oh, will I be seen to be in Maya? Will I be pushed away from the community? Will I be supported? And so I was asking about some difficult situations around, you know, toxic and abusive interactions. And he said a really interesting thing, you know, because I was going through the same dialogue that most people do. Okay, you know, what should you do if somebody's in a toxic or abusive situation? He said, okay, you know, just try, the person should try and get help. And okay, what if they don't respond to help? Well, if they don't respond to help, then the person needs to get out of the situation. Okay, but what if it's your karma? That was my next question. He said, looked very straight in my eyes. He said, you don't have to accept your karma. Yeah, that is a mic drop moment. It still echoes in my ears now, you know, that you don't have to accept your karma. We accept our karma because we identify with the illusion. That's why we have to accept it. If we don't identify as a customer of a particular store, we never take what's, you know, there. If you don't identify yourself as a customer of a particular restaurant, you will never even look at the menu. So then you don't have to order, let alone digest, right? And if you're already in the restaurant and you've ordered, you can cancel your order. And even if your order's arrived, you can choose not to take it. The thing is, why do we take it? I paid for it. Right? This is why we get caught up in this whole karma thing. I paid for it. This is what's coming back to me. So I now have to go back into it. And then something else comes back. And we go back and forth. So this this mood of, you know, understand that actually, yes, we have these activities which have developed our mind and our bodies in a particular way, but that's not all we are. And we don't have to be choked by our karma, good or bad, because even the results of our pious activities can be suffocating. People feel burdened by their opulence, believe it or not, you know, just as much as they feel burdened by their suffering. The other thing I wanted to, you know, really reflect on is Maharaj Pratapurudra's mood of observation and inquiry. There is no harm in observation and inquiry at all. In fact, Srila Prabhupada encourages it. And really, it's his mood of observation and inquiry that has a powerful impact on how much Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya shares with him. And we know this from first canto of Bhagavatam, as Prabhupada's explaining the purports, and you know, as Shukadev Goswami is speaking to Shanaka Rishi, he's explaining that actually just as much as the speaker, the hearer's qualification is so important. And so because Maharaj Pratapurudra's mood of observation and inquiry is submissive. Now, submissive doesn't mean doormat. Submissive doesn't mean blind belief. Okay? It also doesn't mean, inquiry doesn't mean blind doubt. What it means is I'm open and I actually want to know the truth. Some of you here who are teachers, you know, whether you're teaching in the secular world or teaching in our community, you know, maybe you're, you know, running sanghas or mentorship, you'll see that there's different ways people ask questions, and we're also the same. We can recognize in ourselves, am I asking this question because I really want to know, or am I asking this question because I want to put forth a challenging point? Or maybe the answer I've heard really is, you know, irking me at the moment. I don't really want to know the truth. It's a bit too much for me right now, Prabhu. You know, so this submissiveness, this I'm willing to hear, and if I don't get it, I'm willing to park it. You know, and this mood, this relationship we have with our various spiritual masters, shiksha, diksha gurus, etc., it's really important for us. It's really important for our spiritual development. And it's a really powerful tool in actually controlling our minds and taking control of our spiritual life. Because ultimately, behind every voice, behind everything that comes to us is Krishna. Is Krishna directing that person? Because the minute we take shelter of Krishna, regardless of how deep we've gone, just the moment we take shelter, say yes to Krishna, from that moment, he starts to intervene more proactively. Not just directed by our desires as the supersoul, but also directed by, okay, you've made this request now, let's come close together. So I'm going to very consciously, even more consciously than normal, make sure that whatever's happening to you, whoever's coming to you, is really there as a voice to lead you closer to me. And sometimes those voices make sense. Right? We all have those moments, that aha moment. Oh, it all makes sense. The message is beautiful and the person delivering it is beautiful, amazing, you know? And other times, though, the message is unpalatable. And maybe even the person is also unpalatable. So you have double whammy. And those times, still, that's still a representative of the Lord. We have to sometimes park it. So this mood of submissiveness doesn't mean immediate, but it also means that, okay, but I won't push it away, but maybe I can park it. Prabhupada even says this as in terms of the spiritual master's instruction. I saw a short clip, and I know there's a danger with short clips that there may be a loss of context. But you know, we can use Srila Prabhupada's life and his teachings as the context. He states that, he says, you know, the spiritual master's order is to never be given up. He said it can be parked for some time if one has to get on with other things, but then it must be resumed. It cannot be neglected. There's a difference between parking and neglecting. You park your car, right, and go and do something else. You don't neglect it. You don't leave it unlocked. You don't, you know, leave it, you know, one wheel on the curb and one wheel off the curb and your tires and you know, you look after it. So this is whatever we hear, submission also means we take care with what we've received. So this guidance of souls who are close in affection to the Lord is necessary, whether they are our Diksha Guru or otherwise. Because the pure devotees, as we're hearing from this verse and this purport, have this wonderful compassion that is causeless, because they don't really get so much from giving Krishna's love to us, and yet they get everything. They get more of Krishna's love. So when we say causeless, is they will give it to us even before we've really done anything to deserve it. And when we start to really understand what they've given us, we'll realize that anything that we thought we did to deserve it was just a drop in the ocean. So I think this is something that, as you know, we put a lot of emphasis on guru-disciple relationship and guru-tattva. And yes, the Diksha Guru is the primary Shiksha Guru. But we hear from so many wonderful Vaishnavas in this community who are teaching and sharing in their own way, whether your conversation's over washing a couple of pots or whether it's in a big auditorium. Those conversations, I mean, look where this conversation is happening between Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya and Maharishi Prabhudra. I mean, it's such an important conversation, it's made it into Shastra. Okay, where is it happening? It's happening on a balcony. Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya is not sitting on a big, you know, Vyasasan with a microphone and 50 million speakers. He doesn't have a huge audience. He has one sincere listener. So these, we also can take so much example from that, that the association of pure devotees is essential in coming to the most Krishna conscious conclusion with our observations, just like Maharishi Prathapurudra is, whether we're observing something, whether we're experiencing it. If we rely entirely on the filter of our mind, especially whilst our mind is conditioned, and our mind stays conditioned for a long time. Even at Ruchi and Ashakti, there is some degree of conditioning. Even at Bhav, there is a flicker of conditioning, because even up until Bhav, there is a risk of offending others. Right? As long as we are in this body, the risk of anarthas from offenses isn't actually absolutely gone until we have prem. And when we have prem, this body can usually not contain it. So Maharishi Prathapurudra, he's inquiring submissively. He was allowed entrance to have an understanding that is a deeper way to connect with the Lord. Maharishi Prathapurudra is famous for being a devout devotee, right? Very principle-centered, strict with his regulative principles, formidable in making Krishna consciousness available to his citizens. But this raga marg, this, oh, actually, you know, when you have affection for Lord Chaitanya beyond the rules and regulations, where the rules and regulations are not needed to facilitate you, nor do they hamper you, then this is something else. This is some other level. This is when you can really hear the voice of the Lord beyond even the web of lies we tell ourselves through the fanciful words of the Vedas, because we can become attached to also mode of goodness, right? We can get attached to our identities as a devotee in a particular community. And we might not be sectarian within our community, but we may be sectarian against other communities. You know, if we look at Manashiksha, one of the verses in Manashiksha actually speaks about how we must rid ourselves of this sectarian mentality and love all devotees of the Lord, and even those who are doing welfare for mankind. Sometimes we might, you know, look down upon those who are doing welfare, but they're still doing Krishna's work. Right? They'll also, at some point, say yes in whatever shape or form they're ready for when they're ready. So Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya is actually really giving Maharishi Prathapurudra, he's showing him the path, the entrance to the way of the heart, rather than the way of process, right? You want to get from one side of a forest to another. We use a map usually, right? Because a forest can be very easy to get lost in. Unless you're a botanist, most trees look the same, right? And most dirt looks the same. But you know, do you know what I mean? If you're not good at putting down landmarks, have breadcrumbs with you, and even then the birds will eat those. You need a map. But if someone you really care about is on the other side of the forest, you will find a way to get to the other side, no matter what. Path in place or no path in place. So this is the way of the heart. This is the way of the heart. So in the purport, Srila Prabhupada does spend some time talking about why Vedic injunctions can't be ignored. Okay, because our minds are, you know, they're tricky things. They're tricky things. They'll do anything to strengthen that web of illusion. One might read this and go, okay, well, I need to then just work on how what my feelings are like towards Krishna. You know, and until my feelings are there, maybe I can just put aside some of these principles that Prabhupada has given me, maybe relax a bit with those because I want these feelings to wake up. But actually Prabhupada's explained that those feelings that are being talked about, this raga marga, is coming from the spiritual heart. It's not this emotional heart that's part of this mind and this psyche, okay? It's coming from the spiritual heart. And so if we give up the process that gives us the taste and the way to have and access our real heart, our permanent emotional state, right? Then we're never going to get there. We're never going to get there, right? That this thing that, oh, I'm going to start chanting more rounds when I'm feeling more enthusiastic about it. If we don't chant, we'll never feel enthusiastic about chanting. Does that make sense? Even deity worship, you know, the enthusiasm with deity worship increases. And then it ebbs and flows because we get purified. And this is why Prabhupada's elaborating that the Vedic injunctions can't be ignored. Because the methods and routines and prescribed activities around the execution of devotional service, as established by the guru, okay, help to clear the veils of identity, which are made up of our pious and impious acts, okay, as well as our impurities. So these purificatory rites, what they're really doing is making us fit to enter the holy dharms. Let me just break that down a little bit because, you know, sometimes analogies help us a bit more. Anyone here gone swimming? I'm pretty sure most of you have gone swimming. I expect to see loads of hands up. You know, when we go swimming, what do we do? A preliminary thing to get into the swimming pool is what? You have to take a shower. Now I think, well, hang on a minute. The water's clean. In fact, it's got chlorine in it. If anything, if I go in there, I'll probably be cleaner than before I went in. But what we're doing is we're taking a shower before we go in. Yeah, don't dump too much of your stuff in here. You know, there's only so much chlorine we can put in the water, right? So you wash yourself off as much as you can before you come in here. Okay, so this is the thing. This is why we have preparatory measures before we approach the deity. We have archman. You know, we wear clean cloth. We take a bath. We have routines, things that we follow, things we do before we go to the holy dham. We also, most of our purification is done through mantra. We have been prescribed the most powerful process, not just for purification, but to enter the heart of the Lord and to allow him to enter our heart more deeply. So Prabhupada's saying, don't ignore these. Because until we are really at a point where we're not doing these things out of duty, we're doing these things to develop love, but even more so, we're doing these things compelled by love. Right? If you love someone, if you actually love Krishna, why would you approach him dirty anyway? Does that make sense? And if it happens to be by accident, it's just an accident. Just like when you're looking after a baby, you generally approach your baby clean. Mothers don't go, hey, let me take my dirtiest hands to clean. They're like, oh no, I don't want to infect my child. Let me be clean. But if it's immediate, the child needs immediate attention, they will run because it's a heart thing, isn't it? It's not just mothers, fathers too. You know this parental, this strong pull. And it's not just in parental relationships. Anywhere where there's meaning, when there's a heart connection, the rules and regulations we put aside not out of neglect, but because the heart pull is stronger. So you'll see these devotees in Raga Marga, they don't neglect the injunctions on Shastra, but they're compelled to do them out of love. And if we see any discrepancies, the discrepancy is also out of love. Okay. So this is Prabhupada saying, don't give them up. Don't use this verse to think that, okay, well, you know, because I want to get to spontaneous devotional service, let me just start doing that now. No. In fact, actually, as our love for Krishna awakens, that natural affection for him awakens, why would we want to embarrass him and the process that he set up by exhibiting something that's contradictory? Does that make sense? I want to share something from the actual purport that is quoted. Prabhupada goes on to say that have the souls who have achieved the goal of the Vedas. Okay, what's the goal of the Vedas? To always think of Krishna, never forget him. Right? Krishna gives this as a very short, you know, he gives the conclusion in Bhagavad Gita. You know this word, this phrase, shukshma dharma marma. Okay, shukshma means subtle, and marma is like points, intricate points, delicate points, right? Those who do Ayurveda, they know about marma points. They're these very subtle points, very specific points, right? So shukshma dharma marma is there's the subtle intricacies of the Vedas. And the subtle intricacy of the Veda, of the Vedas, is this one statement: they always think of me, never forget me. You know, so those who have already achieved the goal of the Vedas, they're always thinking of Krishna, they're never forgetting him. So they become like walking dhams. They become walking dhams. They become a walking temple, a walking holy place. Because not only is the Lord manifest in their hearts for them, but also for others. And where the Lord is, so is his abode. Okay? And there's this, you know, there's this... Now, when we think of holy place, anywhere where the Lord is worshipped is a holy place, isn't it? Anywhere. Even your own homes. And then you have the dhams, where the Lord actually has his pastimes. Now, the difference between dhams and holy places is an interesting one. The dham is like an embassy. Okay, it's non-different. An embassy runs by the rules of the country of origin. Everything happens exactly like the country of origin, not the country where the place is. And so it is, and the dham is eternal. Whether it's manifest or unmanifest, the dham is eternal. Okay, it's not an expansion, it's just, it's not temporary, it's always there. Even the dham lasts beyond the creation and destruction of the material world. Right? So Goloka Vrindavan, you know, little Vrindavan that we go to now, which seems to be shrinking and getting busier and busier. Yeah, it's been busy, it's been crowded, it's been empty, it's been covered with forest, it's been fully manifest, all of these things, but it never disappears. Whether Brahma's asleep, awake, whether, you know, it's the end of Brahma's life, it actually never disappears. It's always there. Whereas the holy, and so it's always pure. Okay, it's always pure. It doesn't need to be purified. So constantly a state of purity. So actually, even for those souls who always think of Krishna and never forget him, they get a break. They don't have to be going there to neutralize other people's karma and absorb it. Right? They're not going there to refresh the place. They're going also to be refreshed, which is why serious devotees do, if not physically, at least in the mind, live in the dhams. Whereas you look at a holy place is like a portal or a tirtha. It's a gateway, it's an entrance to the Lord's heart, the Lord's abode. So it needs... It comes and goes, it's destroyed, it's created, and its potency fluctuates. Its potency needs to be refreshed by the bhakti and the practices of the devotees there. But of course, people come, as it's explaining here, and they come to have... So many people come here. Everybody's praying for something. How many are praying to surrender completely, right? But we all have to start somewhere. And so these great souls, when they come to places... not wanting to offload, but coming really to give. That is like a walking, talking dham. Just neutralizes, not just neutralizes, it purifies and transforms. And this is what the dham does as well, purifies and transforms. So this is an important point to remember in our temples, also in our homes, that in our homes, if we have temples, the strength of our temple is, yes, dependent on the regularity of our worship and our sincerity and practice. You know, supplementary practices, our sadhana. But it is also dependent on who comes to our home. Who do we entertain in our home? Who speaks in our home? We really should all have a culture that our homes become, you know, for whatever frequency you can manage, twice a year, once a month, once a week, 5 days a week, whatever you can manage, some katha is going on, some kirtan is going on in the home. So, you know, the pure devotees, they take refuge in the dham. Pure devotees purify the holy places. But they never have the mentality that I'm here to purify. They're not consciously going, right, I'm here, I'm a walking dham, I've arrived to purify all of your hearts and absorb all of this. And no, they don't have this mood. In fact, the mood of somebody like that is very, they're usually very, it's not something they do consciously. It just happens. And we feel like this when we're around great souls. We feel like a great burden lifting. But often when we're around great souls, the mind tells us, don't go near them. Isn't it? And that's when we need it the most. Let's go near them when the mind says no. Actually, you know, Prabhupada mentions this purport to Canto 1, Chapter 13, Verse 10. And I just wanted to just share a little bit of his purport, just to elaborate on this point. So in this In this verse, verse 10 of chapter 13 of Canto 1, Yudhishthira Maharaj is speaking to Vidura, who's returned from pilgrimage, and he's inquiring many things. And he actually comments, he says, "My Lord, devotees like your good self are verily holy places personified. Because you carry the personality of Godhead within your heart, you turn all places into places of pilgrimage." So this is what I mean, you know, in our homes, if we invite personalities to speak, if we serve them, they don't just purify, but they actually turn that space into a place of pilgrimage. Srila Prabhupada says, I'm just going to lift certain sections. The Lord's omnipresence is perceived and manifested by his unalloyed devotees like Vidura, just as electricity is manifested in an electric bulb. A pure devotee like Vidura always feels the presence of the Lord everywhere. He sees everything in the potency of the Lord and the Lord in everything. If anyone visits a holy place, he must search out the pure devotees residing in such holy places, take lessons from them, try to apply such instructions in practical life, and thus gradually prepare oneself for the ultimate salvation, going back to Godhead. Now, visiting Vrindavan has become easier than ever before. It's also less austere. You can have anything from a 5-star hotel to 1-star budget, or sleep in the ashram. And so it's attracting all sorts of people. And even in our devotional community, unfortunately, I'm seeing a culture infiltrating, and this is not a criticism, it's just an observation, that devotees are going to Vrindavan very early in their Krishna consciousness, but neglecting hearing, neglecting inquiring, neglecting studying, and neglecting understanding the dharmas through the purports and explanations of senior devotees. And they'll say, oh, I'm going to go to Vrindavan and just absorb myself. And usually, how long can somebody who's, you know, if we're, especially in the early stages of our Krishna consciousness, absorbing ourselves is difficult anyway, right? After a few days in the Dharma and the purification starts, it's even more difficult and one ends up making offenses. So yes, visiting the Dharma is a definitely a necessary parameter, an aspect of Krishna consciousness. But we should try as much as possible, as Prabhupada is recommending very strongly here, that we go and we hear. Okay, hear, search out the pure devotees residing in such holy places. Those who reside there, those who take devotees there, take lessons from them and try to actually apply those instructions in practical life and prepare ourselves. He goes on to say that later on in the purport, the personality of Godhead is always with such pure devotees because of their unalloyed service, which is without any tinge of fruitive action or utopian speculation. Utopian speculation. They are in the actual service of the Lord, specifically by the process of hearing and chanting. The pure devotees hear from the authorities and chant, sing, and write of the glories of the Lord. Maha Muni Vyasadeva heard from Narad, and then he chanted in writing. Shukadeva Goswami studied from his father, and he described it to Parikshit. That is the way of Srimad Bhagavatam. So by their actions, the pure devotees of the Lord can render any place into the place of pilgrimage, and the holy places are worth the name only on their account. Such pure devotees are able to rectify the polluted atmosphere of any place, and what to speak of a holy place rendered unholy by the questionable actions of interested persons who try to adopt a professional life at the cost of the reputation of a holy place. Okay, so of course all sorts of things, you know, go on. Why did I want to share this purport in conjunction with the current purport? Really to emphasize that, you know, this Vaidhi Bhakti that Prabhupada's given us, that is not just Prabhupada's given us, but he's given us, which he's inherited, received from a very well-established, really strong sampradaya, really strong sampradaya, unbroken, okay, recently re-established by Lord Chaitanya himself. It's a necessary stepping stone to this spontaneous attraction. The devotees who were closely associated with Lord Chaitanya, who, you know, Maharaj Pratapurudha was observing, well, some of them have gone to get the maha of Jagannath and they're waiting for a signal from Lord Chaitanya saying, yeah, come, everybody's arrived, let's have prasadam here. They've recognized who the Supreme Personality of Godhead is. And to go, okay, I'm not sure if you're God, so I'm going to just go to the temple. This is not spontaneous love. It's actually, I know who you are, where you are, how you're speaking. You've come in the guise of a devotee, but you're actually the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So if you tell me, bring prasadam now, I will bring it now. I'm not going to defy you. You know, you're hungry. You want to feed your Vaishnavas. I want to please you. Does this make sense? So we can't bypass, this Vaidhi Bhakti. At the same time, we shouldn't dismiss Raga Marg. So we, again, with this black and white thing we have, right? Okay, well, for me to be able to stick to the principles, I've got to pretend that spontaneous devotional service doesn't exist. No, it does. And it's available to everybody. We will all get there because we already have it. It just needs to be uncovered. So we can have both. We can understand, maybe I'm not there yet, but one day I can get there and give ourselves permission to have these conversations. And in this way, we won't lose enthusiasm. Enthusiasm is so necessary. We know this from Nectar of Instruction. We know this from our own lives. And enthusiasm, not just the feeling of enthusiasm, but what Prabhupada defines it as, which is endeavoring with intelligence. Endeavoring with intelligence. And if we wait for enthusiasm to just be a feeling, it's very short-lived. Enthusiasm is a complete, state. We're not just feelings. We have thoughts. We act. Enthusiasm, Prabhupada gives it as a verb. So when we understand that, yes, I'm here, but actually the goal is possible, there's different stepping stones, and there are people in our community who are also getting to those different stepping stones, who are ahead, and they are allowed to be that way, and I'm allowed to become that as also, then it keeps us enthusiastic, okay? It allows us to keep endeavoring with intelligence, because we must take more control of our own spiritual lives. It can't be passive. Anartha Nivritti and preparing ourselves to receive what's to come is a conscious activity, okay? If it's passive, it takes a long time. So, I just want to conclude with that, we all want to get to the point where we're doing all the things that please Krishna and Guru because we're compelled by love. But we can't bypass the principles to get there, nor should we ignore the fact that actually it's most natural for us to be compelled by love. And I would say, when you go home, have a think about why you have affection for Krishna, why you're interested in Krishna. And this is a good exercise for us. I find it useful because it reminds me, one, that, wow, I've got so much to be grateful for. But secondly, that it's not quite unconditional yet. It's not quite spontaneous, because spontaneous means, why do you love Krishna? I don't know. I just do, right? This was Janani. Someone asked Janani, a child asked Janani Vas Prabhu, what's Raga Nuga Bhakti? And Janani Vas Prabhu asked them, he said, do you love Krishna? They were like, yes. I said, why do you love Krishna? I don't know, I just love him. He said, that's spontaneous. So thank you very much. We have some time for your comments, your own reflections. This has been such a nice section of CC to share with all of you. Please. Do we have a mic for Prabhuji?
For me, the basic knowledge comes through Srila Prabhupada, and he says in Bhagavad Gita that to get that knowledge, we have to inquire submissively and render service to that this self-realized souls. They impart knowledge to you, so you learn all the things that you need to know from the self-realized soul.
434, you're looking at the purport. 434,
yeah. And then 435, it says, having obtained real knowledge from the self-realized soul. Sorry, having obtained this knowledge from the self-realized souls, submissively, serving him, then you'll never fall again into illusion. For by this knowledge, you'll understand that all living beings are part of the Supreme, and they belong to me. And that belonging to me is that we have a destiny, a place to go, that is forever free from this material existence. And when Krishna says, when it says, they belong to me, that means we belong back with him. Mm. That's what I see it.
Thank you. Thank you for keeping us enthusiastic with the destination in mind. Hare Krishna. I think there's a couple of, at the back, Vajna Krishna, and then Nita Kirtan Prabhu, and then yourselves.
Hare Krishna. Thanks for class. My question was that you made this point, you don't have to accept your karma. Could you just give a couple of examples to illustrate that?
You want examples in terms of to help you to understand the concept better? The minute, the best example I can give is, you know, we often talk about that karma that's already manifest, right? That, oh, you can't take that back. You can't get rid of that. We have got more that is manifest than we realize. We forget that the already manifested karma is, for example, this body, the color of our hair, our height. There's so many things that we can't change, right? But we don't have to accept them. We don't have to be defined by them in our relationship with Krishna. And we see examples of this throughout Shastra. And it's shown at that point when various Vaishnavas in various different varnas and ashrams and situations decide to drop and not accept their karma and just surrender to Krishna's instruction. For example, you look at Arjun. After 45 minutes of hearing from Krishna, he stops accepting his karma. His life is no longer dictated just by his karma because he completely surrenders. Marika Tvanga, he's only got a few moments left to live. He's giving up this body. Now, he could accept future bodies, more bodies. There's always something in the ether, but he doesn't. He surrenders completely, gives up his karma. Doesn't accept his karma. So many examples of this. You know, there's a... You look at Maharaj Parikshit. Now, he's been cursed. There's this snake bite arriving. And the only thing that snake bite was able to harm was his body. It couldn't touch him. Does that make sense? So not accepting our karma is not about trying to block an activity from happening to us. And this is the thing that I think, you know, Maharaj really wanted, I think, especially when he communicated this. It's not just about stopping the situation. It's really about how am I receiving this.
It's like the attitude that you have towards
it. Yeah, absolutely. Because when our attitude changes, a lot of the enemies of the mind, they abate. Whether it's fear, anger, whatever it is, disappointment, dejection, they abate. Because all of those, they bewilder the intelligence. We don't take proper action when we're under the influence of those. And when they abate, it's much easier then for us to act in a way that is best, not just for our Krishna consciousness, but also best for the reality at hand. We're not swayed by our attachments or repulsion to various social dynamics. Because if we're honest with ourselves, even how we view our position in society, we cling to particular social parameters and others we actually are repulsed by. And we're all different like that. And we'll cling to Vedic parameters that suit us and neglect the ones that don't suit us. Does that make sense? We cherry pick. So this thing about, you know, we don't have to accept our karma is really more about surrendering. The only real way to not accept our karma is to really do an about turn, pivot. Does that make sense?
Hare Krishna. Thank you for such a wonderful class. You really opened up my mind to things I hadn't thought about before. Regards karma, how do we understand the difference between something that Krishna wants and something that is, let's say, is our karma? Mm. So sometimes I get asked the question that, let's say, somebody is struggling to get married. They're looking for a partner. And then they're struggling. And then it's like, oh, well, maybe Krishna doesn't want me to get married. So how do we understand that what is actually what Krishna wants and that we should keep trying, or actually it's just our karma and we have to go through.
Yeah, because there's a karmic ceiling to things, isn't there? Because all this thing that's thrown around that you can get anything you want whenever you want, just put your mind to it. Well, no, you can't have it whenever you want. You might have to wait a few lifetimes, you know. But it makes a lot of people a lot of money. That just getting people into that mindset. It's a good question, and it's one that comes up frequently. So, I think our nature to want to understand why something is happening to us is that we're looking for the grace in it. We're looking for the grace in it. We're looking for the good favor in it. And when things are difficult, it may be easier for us to accept the difficulty, knowing that, oh, Krishna wants this. Krishna never wants us to be in difficulty. He's a loving person. He's the personification of love. The personification of love is not going to go, you know, my preference is you suffer to come to me. This is not the voice of a loving person, okay? His choice is always throughout Shastra, come to me, always think of me, never forget me, come to me. You'll be so happy if you come to me. Be so happy if you just do what I say, you'll be so happy. You know, you won't come back, you won't have to suffer anymore. So this is, everything is directed by that. Whether we experience suffering, happiness, gratitude in response to it is largely down to how we view it. So whether what we're experiencing is a test because someone's karma free and liberated and Krishna is using them as an example, whether it's the consequence of an offense or whether it was just some karma that's due to us, maybe we were really rubbish at finding a partner, we were really rubbish to someone in our previous life, so it's taking us time to find a partner in this lifetime. It doesn't really matter what pathway it's come through. What Krishna's really wanting is, how are you going to use this to show me that you're serious about us? Right? I was reflecting yesterday on, Bhaktisiddhartha Maharaj often reminds us that Krishna consciousness is the greatest romance. And there's no such thing as obstacles. This is in Bhagavatam, third canto. There's no such thing as obstacles in Krishna consciousness, just the ones we perceive. And he would always say, see it as part of the adventure. And I was just thinking about romantic films, romantic songs. If you look at we're obsessed with romance. What does romantic mean? Romantic actually means the best way, the most close, right? That's what romantic means. And so we want romantic friendships, we want romantic romance, we want romantic everything, like the best of everything. I was just thinking about romantic films in terms of conjugal love or even something like Frozen. Okay, it's a romantic sisterhood, isn't it? Well, yeah, I'll do anything for you. That's the romantic mood, I'll do anything for you. And actually, if you look at the storyline of a romantic, two people meet, they fall in love, they get together. I mean, you could do that movie in 60 seconds, right? The entertainment, what do we enjoy is the drama. Will they? Won't they? They've got this obstacle. How will they get around this obstacle? And do they really mean that much to each other? And the same in our own lives. Does this person, do I really mean that much? Oh, wow, they prioritize me over this challenge that they had. They must really love me, right? So this life is an adventure and Krishna consciousness is the greatest romance. Really, when we have challenges, if we view them as, this really is about will I, won't I, Krishna Singh, how am I going to use this situation to surrender more, to let go more, to come out of the web of illusion more? I may still have to be a family person. I may still have to work. I may still have to look after this body. I may yet not be having ecstatic symptoms. Okay, but he's seeing, how serious are you about me? Right? It's really interesting. We put all these conditions on how people should love us, but we expect Krishna to have no conditions at all. But actually, he's been unconditional the whole time. We're the ones who've put conditions on him. Does that make sense? So yeah, I think it's, Krishna never wants us to suffer. And I think when people ask, is he doing this to me because he wants it? No, all he wants is, what are you going to do with this situation? That for your long-term Krishna consciousness is going to be the best thing for you. Is that okay? Thank you. Hare Krishna. Do we have time for one more? Yeah, okay. Sorry, Prabhu, what's your name?
Thanks for a wonderful class, Mataji. Just one question you might have already told. So you said the difference between dhams and holy places. So we hear that we have Mathura dham, Dwarka, Mayapur dham. So wherever God goes, Krishna goes, that becomes dham. And we feel that this is holy place also. So
yes,
both. How means you differentiate between these two things?
So dham is always going to be a holy place, right? When we're making the distinction between a holy place other than a dham, is it's been established. For example, where you put a temple, or whether it's in your home or an established temple. Does that make sense? Or where class is going on. Like one of the reasons Naimisharanya Forest is so famous is because look at the katha that's gone on there. Wherever God has had his pastimes is a dham. Okay, where his glories are spoken, where he is worshipped, immediately becomes holy. But the point I was making is it needs to be topped up. Does that make sense? It's not that it's by nature transcendental. It's been made transcendental because of what's being spoken about, what's being practiced. Right? If this will never happen, hopefully. But let's just say, you know, a particular temple is knocked down and it's turned into a block of flats. The potency will be there, but it will carry through to the degree that that kind of consciousness is still continued to practice in those block of flats, but it'll come to a point where it will unmanifest, dissipate. Whereas the dham, whether it's covered or uncovered, so when Lord Chaitanya was here, the Vrindavan was covered in forest. It was lost. He charged the, you know, he put in charge the Goswamis to discover Vrindavan based on their realization, not a map, realization. And but the dham hadn't gone anywhere. Does that make sense? It didn't need purifying. It didn't need someone to go, okay, well, we need to invoke the dham with special prayers. No, he just wanted to make the dham visible and available to all. Does that make sense? Okay. Ladies have been quiet with their questions today and maybe attentively listening. I don't know. Thank you so much for your association. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.